British Public Radio. Comedy.
This programme contains themes of an adult nature. Listener discretion is advised.
Didn't Liza Minnelli already have a gay marriage?
Answer me this, answer me this.
How much rent can I charge you to live in my garage?
Answer me this, answer me this. Helen and Ollie, answer me this.
Hey listeners, I hope you stuck around to the end of last week, because right at the end, I inadvertently set you a challenge, which was essentially deciding whether I was right in thinking that you would remember Arrested Development's 1992 pop hit, Mr. Wendell, or whether Martin was right, that you wouldn't.
And guess what? We're covering this right at the top of this week's episode, so I think we can safely conclude that Martin must be wrong.
In your face, Martin.
Yeah, there are four people on Twitter who know who Arrested Development were.
Well, actually, this is the thing, isn't it? We've had lots of you write in to say, of course I get that reference. It probably is more than four. It's probably more like 24. But, of course, if you don't know the reference, you're not going to write in and say, I don't know it, because then you look stupid. So Martin could be right that the majority of the listeners didn't.
How much do you think the $2 in Mr. Wendell would be worth now? You know, $2 just a snack for me, but it means a big deal to you. I mean, what are you going to get out of Pret-a-Manger for $2?
Well, $2 is, yeah, what's that, £1.30?
Popcorn.
Yeah, maybe an egg sandwich, if you take away.
One of those half sandwiches, though, not
a full one. Half sandwich. Yeah, it doesn't mean a great deal to anyone.
Interesting Arrested Development fact, by the way. The band Arrested Development sued the TV show Arrested Development.
Oh, even that's upset me.
No one is going to mistake the two.
Exactly.
And the psychological syndrome piped up. So, excuse me, I think I was here before all of you.
But anyway, Gareth from Vancouver gets a worthy mention amongst those people who recognised this reference.
The legion of you.
Because he's kind of the king of cultural references, because he says, I got the reference to Mr. Wendell, Helen.
Yes, nailed it, Gareth.
But I also remember the episode of Game On in which the nose was cut off the cheese. Well, see what else you can fox him with, Helen. Maybe something you spotted in the background of an episode of Twin Peaks.
Hey, you remember that sitcom set in a tennis academy called Phenom? Get back to me on it, Gareth.
I don't even know if you're joking.
Mid-90s, Channel 4.
Oh, it's incredible, isn't it, to think what you could do with your brain if you weren't wasting it with all this shit.
It's so awful.
It's amazing. Seriously, she's got a massive head, listeners. Literally, massive big skull.
I do have a really...
Like Shakespeare. She could put so much in there.
I have a really thick skull. That's the Zaltzman thing. Big head. Not necessarily a bigger brain. But it's good that I have a thick skull, because the other day, a large bottle of Cobra fell off the top of the fridge about 5 feet onto my head.
And actually, wasn't it on top of the microwave on top of the fridge as well?
And so I was sitting down.
Quite a lot of height there.
It was a big fall. It was a big bottle of beer. And I survived because of my thick Zaltzman skull.
Right. Time for a question now. This is from Matthew in Camden, who says, I just smelt a man passing me in the street. He says this was unintentional.
Yeah, it usually is.
The only time I ever do anything with intent regarding smelling people who pass me, it's intending not to. I'm not that proud of this. It's just true. If I see someone who looks like they've been sleeping rough for a bit too long and I think they might smell, I actually breathe out as I approach them so that I don't breathe in until I've passed them, so I don't get that horrible smell.
Or often, if a lady is wearing a very strong vanilla perfume, I have to run off.
How can you tell visually, though, that someone's... You've already smelt it by that point.
She's got a big V written on her face.
Matthew says, this man who passed me in the street was wearing the Abercrombie scent.
Oh, well.
And there was a decided tug in my loins.
That was probably a tendon, or maybe your pants were too tight.
No, Helen, answer me this. Is there some scientific reason for my lusty urge?
I wonder whether it is triggering a kind of scent memory, because those are really powerful. Even if you don't want them to be.
Yeah, especially, Matthew, if you've walked past a branch of Abercrombie and there've been one of those muscly teenagers standing there in their pants outside getting hypothermia because it's Britain.
That sounds very degrading thing to find attractive.
That's, well...
Some people do,
though. It sells, Helen. But anyway, I always feel sorry for them because they're teenagers. If it was girls, they would not allow it, would they?
They're getting paid for doing nothing. If it was girls, they would be paid a lot less and it'd be in a bar that was windowless.
Yeah, anyway.
Anyway.
I wonder if perhaps you've passed one of those gentlemen before, found them sexually attractive, and so you're triggering the emotion memory of that.
My emotion memory, though, is really weird because it's... I suppose because it's attached to a lot of experiences in my teens of pulling people who smell of booze and cigarettes.
Mm.
Neither smells are ones that I particularly like, but often I get a whiff of a particular booze and cigarette combo and that I think... That's the pulling smell.
Can't
stop me now.
It's revealing, isn't it? That, you know, for one man, it could be the smell of Abercrombie. For you, it's the smell of stale cigarettes and alcohol.
Pub carpet. Here's a question from Tina, who says, Ollie, answer me this. Do you know what the song Whiter Shade of Pale is about.
Yeah, it's about a band taking too many drugs and then writing a thing that people for years later are like, what's it about? And they're like, oh, we're not going to tell you in this interview. We're going to tease you. They're not going to ever tell you because it's about drugs. It's meaningless.
They don't know.
Yeah, they don't know. They have no memory of writing it, almost certainly. But I mean, there are some images in there.
Whiter.
Which, yes,
you know,
yeah.
Like the drugs are white.
The phrase "whiter shade of pale" apparently is to do with the bloke who wrote it saw a girl at a party say it to another girl, as in you're feeling a bit sick, you're looking a whiter shade of pale.
Okay.
And the phrase just kind of stuck in his head. And when he talks about the 15 Vestal Virgins, people have said that's maybe groupies. It's a Summer of Love thing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Like, you know, it could be a VW camper van full of hot chicks.
And when Annie Lennox so memorably covered this song,
yes.
Do you think that she just created a different narrative for it? Because she doesn't seem like the Vestal Virgin type.
No. And I think to persuade Annie Lennox to sing a song about anything, you have to tell her it's about orphans in Rwanda, even if it's not.
Or Nelson Mandela getting out of jail.
Yeah. Yeah, the record company are like, for your next song, Annie, we'd like you to do a cover of Come On Eileen. It's about the Spanish Civil War.
and then you could do Heroin by the Velvet Underground, which is about Joan of Arc.
I got a question. Email your question. To answer me. This podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com. Answer me this podcast at googlemail.com.
Here's a question from Emma, who says, I have a lovely new boyfriend of two or so months. He is too young for you.
Hands off, Emma.
Boom.
Everything is going very well.
Good.
Having met relevant friends and family.
Oh, only the relevant ones. No, Uncle Jim, you cannot meet my new boyfriend. You are irrelevant.
You are a subplot. We each have good feelings in regard to our future together.
Well, everything sounds fine, Emma. Why have you written to us?
Just one thing.
Oh.
Like in Columbo.
We actually met through an online dating site, and each time the question is asked, oh, so where did you meet? I shift uncomfortably in my seat and mumble something about meeting at a party. He's aware that I haven't exactly told the truth to my family and friends, but he says he doesn't mind. I just feel that at the age of 24, with a professional job, that having to say, I met my partner online seems a bit odd. Does she mean 24 is too old to say that or 24 is too young to say that?
I have a theory on that,
okay,
Helen.
Okay, I'll
wait. Let's get to the question
first. Yes, Ollie, answer me this. Should I come clean?
You should do whatever you're comfortable with. It's obviously your discomfort that's stopping you from admitting that you met on an online dating site. Don't force it if you feel uncomfortable. But the question I would ask is, why? Why do you feel uncomfortable that
Where's
you met on an online
it?
Dating site? Surely everyone does that now.
Yeah. Masses.
Except. I was talking to my girlfriend's younger sister about this,
mm-hmm.
who is 22. And she said that she wouldn't ever go on an online dating site because it's seen as being a naff thing to do. It's seen as something you do when you're a bit older, when you failed to find people.
So for her, what was that cutoff point of becoming older and therefore needing the dating site?
I think about 26.
Oh my God, that's so old.
It's
interesting, isn't it? If you're not paired off by then, it's curtains for you.
I, like you, Helen, had assumed that everyone in the generation younger than us, because most people our age are comfortable with it,
yeah.
would be totally fine with it. But actually, apparently, it's still a bit of a taboo, which is interesting, isn't it?
Because I think even 10 years ago, people were no longer ashamed that this was the way they'd met. But if it's such a problem for you, Emma, why don't you make up some really outlandish way that you met? Like, oh, I met him because I did a skydive and I landed on him. You might feel most comfortable telling a lie that is quite close to the truth. So you could say that you were set up on a blind date by your friends. Or that you met in the restaurant or bar or cinema, wherever you did go on your first date.
Yeah, by our friends Firefox and Chrome.
I disagree with you, Ollie, about her only doing what she's comfortable with. I think she would be uncomfortable for a short period of time, but then comfortable that she told the truth. Whereas at the moment, the fact that she's written to us suggests she's not comfortable with her lie.
I suppose it depends what website it was, mind you. If it was womenbehindbars.com, then I'd understand you feeling a bit reserved.
Uniform dating. What is that about, listeners? Are any of you on that? Because that seems degrading in both ways, really.
Well, now, it's interesting that I've always interpreted the need for uniform dating to be that people who work in various services like the company
much.
Of other people, yeah, and they understand, exactly. So if you're in the police, you understand someone who works for an ambulance. I don't think it's necessarily saying I'm turned on by paramedics, but it's always interpreted that way in the press, isn't it?
Well, because the adverts are, oh, if you find bus conductors sexy.
Yeah.
It's not saying if you want to be the pen pal of someone in the army for 6 months, and then when they come home, you'll meet them and have a wonderful romantic union.
Yeah. Well, that's right, because it's less of a story, isn't it? It's like, you know, if it's Christian dating or something,
but I think
then you understand that it's because they have, because they come from the same place religiously. It's not because it turns them on. But for some reason, when it's uniforms, people always assume that it's a sex thing.
I think if I were the uniformed person, I would think, do they like me or just the clothes that have been supplied to me by the government?
Yeah.
So having lived this lie, how does she now undo the lie? Does she just say, actually, I lied? Or does she just start feeding in the story when new people ask her and hope it gets back to the old people and overwrites their memory?
I don't know, Helen, because the whole time you were saying that, I was trying to recall the lyrics to Stop Living the Lie by David Snedden.
Oh, no!
All I could remember
was... How could you do that?
Sorry, that's going to be in your head for the next week.
But maybe Gareth from Vancouver will write in and say, I remember David Snedden. Thousands wouldn't.
Is that a Fame Academy person?
He won the first series of Fame Academy.
He's a songwriter now. He writes songs for Hertz.
He was like a young Gary Barlow.
But seriously, do you remember how it went until the
Stop
bit where it would
living
live in
the lie?
Yeah, but before that, how did it go?
So bland.
What was the lie that he was living?
I think it was... something to do with the correct visas for the country he was visiting at the time. He was only on a student visa, but he was no longer a student.
Right, yeah. Actually, I'd forgotten this, but I've seen David Snedden on the street. I saw him once on Upper Street. I was in the 19 bus.
And you were like, that's David Snedden! Everybody, go to that side! It's David Snedden!
No, I did exactly what anyone in my position in the 21st century would do. I reached for my smartphone and I started composing an ironic tweet about it. And then I thought, no, that's a real man. And I'm not going to belittle him, but like, oh, look at him trying to be all clever, living.
Hello. I'm Wilson, the ball from Castaway. And here is my song about my favourite balls. Football, rugby ball, volleyball ball, tennis ball, Zoe ball, basketball, netball, handball, debutante ball, bowling ball, baseball, big sweaty ball.
Answer Me This Sports Day, a marathon of fun and games, out now at answermethispodcast.com/albums.
Listeners, if you want to get in touch via the telephone, then this is the number you need to dial.
0208-123-5877.
Or you may Skype Answer Me This.
You may.
You may. This person was also given permission to do that.
Anthony from Leyland. Helen Ollie, Answer Me This. I was wondering the other day, where did the ritual of a bride throwing the bouquet to all the other people at a wedding come from?
This is a bit of a weird one.
We like it when it's a bit weird, don't we, Helen?
Oh, yes, we love it weird.
We feast on it.
Well, you could actually have feasted on a bridal bouquet because way back when, in the Middle Ages, they used to be made out of garlic and dill.
I'd actually prefer that.
When the brides were walking down the aisle with the garlic and the dill, they would feed the guests the dill because that was meant to be a herb that made you feel more sexy. What they also used to do at weddings was tear off bits of the bride's dress, which was meant to confer some of the romantic luck onto the people that got a bit of the dress as
right.
a token.
Yes.
And then over the years, when people started spending more and more extortionate amounts on wedding dresses,
The tradition mutated into this thing that the bride can carry that's clearly temporary anyway.
Yes, that's right.
Keep.
And also a distraction, because you can throw it over there and then scarp her.
You can throw it over all the really weird people who are grabbing onto your dress, can't you, and then run away. Classic distraction technique, isn't it? Look, over there, run.
I often do that with the dog and a tennis ball. I'm going to start taking tennis balls to weddings.
But surely some brides would like to dry the flowers in their bouquet and keep the bouquet.
Well, then you have to snatch it back off the spinster that's grabbed it.
Also, I just realised I'm saying bouquet, but people usually say bouquet. I've never given it any thought.
I say bouquet.
Do you say bouquet?
It's not a word I have much occasion to
Martin,
say.
Martin, bouquet, I've, bouquet?
Bouquet.
Okay.
I've never had a bouquet or a bouquet.
Yeah. You didn't have a bouquet or a bouquet at your wedding?
No.
Why not?
Because I thought about them and I thought, I don't see the point of those.
Yeah,
I don't even like the deconstructed bouquets where they're made out of a bundle of vintage brooches or something, because it's still something that I'd have to carry, and our wedding had quite uneven terrain.
Yeah.
I needed my hands for balance.
What about a wedding walking stick?
That would be cool.
Hi, this is Alex from Xinjiang. Helen, I'll answer me this. My best friend is getting married, and obviously I need to wear a suit for this. Can I wear the same suit I wore for my own wedding 2 years ago? It's a good suit, and I think it would look pretty nice. However, it's kind of tainted with my failed marriage. So can you wear the same suit to a different wedding?
I was all for it, Alex, until you went on about the failed marriage.
Yeah, it's you're asking two questions, really, aren't you? Can you recycle a suit that you wore at a wedding?
Yes,
absolutely.
If it's a nice suit, I think they'll be pleased you're wearing such a nice suit.
Yeah, especially, I think you can't say it the other way around. I don't think you should wear for a wedding, for your wedding, a suit you've worn before.
Oh,
I think it should be new.
Someone I know is doing just that, and I thought, yeah, if he likes that suit more than another suit, then why not?
I'm not saying it has to be an expensive suit or even a new suit. It can be secondhand, but it should be new to you.
Get a cheap suit that's worse than your other suit that you might want to
wear. Yeah, I do think it should be special, yes. But anyway, the second question, far more interesting, that he's actually asking, if you've had a failed wedding, can you then wear that suit again, or is it jinxed?
Maybe this will reset the suit back to a positive suit.
I had a car crash once wearing a Gap jumper, and for the rest of the time I had that jumper, my friend who was with me at the time would never get in a car with me again.
Wow!
Mm. Just in case.
It's not the jumper that was driving, it was you!
Exactly.
I think it's important, though, Alex, to check whether the suit you had for your wedding is going to be suitable for the time of year. Suitable, I didn't mean that. I mean, I meant it, but I didn't intend it. Is it going to be suitable for the climate at this new wedding? Say if you got a linen suit and the wedding's going to be cold, you don't want to wear that. Or if you got a wool suit and the wedding's going to be hot, you don't want to wear that.
Right.
You don't want to be sweaty.
There was a couple in the Sun on Sunday last weekend who were getting married in onesies.
They should not be allowed.
I don't know if they were just doing it so they got in the paper.
Oh, then they should not be allowed. They should not be allowed to be near people at all if that's their intention for wearing the onesies.
The thing is, it was kind of fun. Like, especially this week when everyone's been saying, you know what, you should be able to marry whoever you want if you're an adult. You know, everyone's entitled to equal rights of marriage.
No,
everyone should be entitled to wear whatever they want, surely.
But everyone should be entitled not to marry somebody who would be willing to wear a onesie to a wedding,
yeah,
even if they're just a guest.
But if you're also inclined to wear a onesie, then you're marrying the right person, aren't you?
You should think, I should not inflict myself on someone else. It's your wedding day. Wear something good. You could wear a onesie every evening on your own sofa.
Yeah, this was a special onesie, though. I suppose normally in the wedding suite, it's tricky to get the lady out of her dress anyway. So in a way, it doesn't matter that it's going to take the man an equal amount of time.
That's traditionally why they tie things to the back of a wedding car, metal objects. They put a tin opener on there so the man can get her out the dress.
Is that true?
No,
I didn't think so.
Good that you sort of believed it for
second,
though.
Well, no, I believe that it was a traditional joke.
I just made it up.
Yeah, no, I know that now, Helen.
It's nouveau.
Yes, but the style of Call My Bluff that you succeeded in doing was I believed it was a traditional joke.
If you think you can best him with a tricky question, send it in on that internet thing to Google.
Here's a question from Neil from Crawley, who says, Ollie, answer me this. Did people live in Downing Street prior to it becoming the home and office of the First Lord of the Treasury?
Yes, obviously. It would be a bit weird if, in preparation for it becoming the Prime Minister's house.
Get out, everybody, get out.
Yeah, it must be empty for 200 years to keep it chased.
Oh, really? If they only had it for that long? Because he also says, if so, did the government buy the whole street or just numbers 10 and 11?
Downing Street was built by a bloke called James Downing, who very modestly named it after himself. And
it's better than calling it Government Street, isn't
it? Okay, so the answer is it wasn't Government Street. It was houses built by James Downing. That's what it was.
Yeah.
They had a nice aspect onto St James's Park. They were near the seat of power.
Very convenient for
work. Very convenient. They were always designed for persons of stature.
Difficult to buy anything, though. I mean, there's that tiny little convenience store on the end of Westminster Bridge, but where are you going to get... You're going to have to walk all the way out to Victoria Street to get toilet roll and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. But it was built for, I imagine, people who did work in the government, but it was a private venture. It wasn't owned by the government. So number 10 Downing Street. Mm. The Earl of Grantham, like as in the character Hugh Bonneville plays in Downton Abbey, the Earl of Grantham lived at 10 Downing Street.
Wow.
From 1699 to 1703.
Where did he buy his toilet roll? We'll never know.
But it didn't become the residence of the Prime Minister until 1735.
Oh, right. So they just bought the street.
They weren't built for the government. Mm. They weren't purchased all at once by the government. But after a few hundred years, slowly, they all evolved into being owned by the government. But even then, it's not like, you know, you use the phrase the government.
Yes.
But actually, it's all different pots of money, isn't it? So one was the tithe office and one was the colonial office or whatever.
Well, it's like Victoria Street now. One is the DTI.
Exactly.
One
like
is
that.
DEFRA.
Exactly like that. Yeah. So over time, with hundreds of years perspective, you're like, oh, that street belongs to the government. But it wasn't really like that.
It's
individual
more just no one else is going to get
it.
Any of it.
Well, it's like you say, very convenient location for the Houses of Parliament.
Yeah, but it's also a very convenient location if you work as an ice cream vendor in Trafalgar Square, but no one thinks of their industry, do they?
Hello, Ed here. Helen and Ollie, answer me this. Where does the phrase, I heard it through the grapevine, actually come from?
Complete wild guess.
Yeah.
Shakespeare?
That is a much more cerebral wild guess than your wild guesses usually are.
Because I was thinking it sounds a bit like, you know that bit in Twelfth Night where, is it Toby and Thingy are spying on Malvolio?
Uh-huh.
Sounds a bit, you could imagine, couldn't you, being surrounded by grapevines in a sort of Italianate scene.
Yeah.
That sort of phrase came about, even if it isn't in the play, someone said, you know, it's the grapevine scene.
Right.
Sorry, that was just my instinctive feeling. It's obviously wrong from the way you're looking at it.
I think that's quite sensible.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
But it's wrong.
But it's not your fault, Ollie. I think it was a really good go, but it's actually a bit later than that.
It's your fault, Shakespeare. Why didn't you prefigure Marvin Gaye?
Idiot. Anyway, the first recorded use of it was from 1852, and it referred to the telegraph system that had been instituted in America in the 1840s, and the wires looked like grapevines. They transmitted the messages.
Oh, so it was kind of like a nickname for the telephone system.
Yeah.
So a bit like, I guess, if someone did a song, I heard it through the information superhighway in 1995.
Yeah.
Actually, Marvin Gaye does sound more like the name of a telephone engineer than a Motown star, doesn't it?
No.
That's only. I think that's only because Marvin Gaye is Marvin Gaye.
Right.
If you went into a little office.
Name a Motown star that sounds more like a Motown star. Like Diana Ross. Couldn't that be someone who works in a call centre?
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Berry Gordy. Couldn't that be someone who works cleaning toilets?
No, Berry Gordy. That's
almost like a name of, you know, one of those American brands that you're meant to think is made by a rosy-cheeked lady in her farmhouse kitchen.
Yeah, it was actually a massive corporation. Yeah.
Yeah, but Berry Gordy's home-cooked biscuits.
I just don't think Marvin's a sexy name. That's what I'm saying.
Well,
I
mean, how about this as a
Martin,
name?
However.
Dream on, mate.
How about this as a sexy name, Martin? Greg.
Yeah.
Does that make you excited?
I always think about Greg Proops.
Do you? God, I didn't know Martin did impressions as well. He's so versatile.
It's like we're in the room with Greg Wallace right now.
It's got butter in its biscuits.
This is from Greg in Loughborough.
Sexy place.
Who said it is. Loughborough is a very sexy place.
Loughborough,
more like.
What?
Who says, Helen, answer me this. I almost forgot the format of the show. We'd been on such a long tangent. Helen, answer me this. Why do people say the moon is made of cheese?
Because they are scientific idiots.
Well, it looks a bit like it's made of cheese.
Well, exactly, Ollie.
Yeah, it's the same as the grapevine thing, isn't it? Looks a bit like that. It's going to become a saying, isn't it?
It's a big, round, pale thing.
Yeah.
That's why people said it looked like a cheese.
Why didn't they say it was an apple or something?
Because it's not green, it's not got a stalk, and
no,
apple's not
round. If you bisect an apple, it looks more like the moon.
Well, it's not as catchy. The moon looks like a bisected apple tonight, dear.
But it also looks a bit like a bowling ball, doesn't it? And people have said that as well.
But this expression's from
sticks.
Before. The
yeah.
cheese thing is really old. There's some weird myth as well that they saw the moon reflected in the water and the village idiot thought that it was a cheese, so he tried to eat the cheese and drown.
There's also the issue, of course, that in our lifetime, obviously, we've seen footage of the moon that itself looks old. You know, we've seen black and white footage of people on the moon who are older than us, who are now dead.
Dancing around in the dust.
Yeah, so to us, the idea of lunar exploration, although exciting, doesn't seem distant. Whereas, even 200 years ago, the moon seemed so unfathomably far away that actually it might as well be made of cheese. You'd never know. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So something like that, you could see how someone might be able to convince even a sort of teenager that the moon is genuinely made of cheese, because you'd have no idea, would you, basically, how it all works.
When was Yuri Gagarin? Is that 61 or something? So, I mean, even before then, even in the 50s, you must have thought, oh, yeah, like, maybe we can send a rocket up there, but there's no way people are
But it's obviously made of cheese. Yeah. So, I mean, so we better bring forks.
Yeah, let's hope it's not a soft cheese, otherwise we'll never get off again.
Well, the Apollo missions have had tons and tons of celery into the lining of the spacecraft.
Martin knows because we went to the Kennedy Space Centre.
Yeah, it's all about celery. It's quite boring, actually.
They had a whole exhibition about space chutney.
I'm an Answer Me This fan. I listen with my nan. She is not so keen. She finds it too obscene. I follow them on Twitter, though Ashton Kutcher's fitter. I want to take things further, just one step short of murder. I want to look like Ollie Man. I want to smell like Ollie Man. I want to be like Ollie Man. I want to chase like Ollie Man.
Listeners, get yourself really hyped up now for an exciting question about shelving from the phone line.
James from Bury.
Helen and Ollie, answer me this. When organising your DVDs, do you put them in alphabetical order or do you put them in genre? And if you have a TV series and say you have one DVD which is Blu-ray and one that isn't, do you split them up or do you keep them together?
I'm not sure we have enough DVDs to have a system, do we?
We've got three shelves. I mean, they are badly stacked.
Yeah, well, describe your system, because I'd agree with Martin that it would be an insult to the word to call it a system.
Ignore all the other stuff like nail varnish and sweets that are on the DVD shelves. The top shelf, that is games and DVDs that we haven't seen and plan to.
Right. Oh, so not traditionally racy material like you'd find on a normal top shelf.
We keep it in the attic. middle shelf,
yeah,
that is specifically box sets.
Yeah.
Bit of Breaking Bad there.
Yeah, Brass Eye.
A Frank Capra box set.
30 Rock.
Arrested Development.
Northern Exposure. But also we've got a little wooden chest of drawers that's got some tools and medications in. And then bottom shelf...
it's not medication to take when you watch the box set.
It's medication.
It's like Breaking Bad-themed medication.
It's where we keep the crystal meth if you're ever over.
Good to know.
And then the bottom shelf, that is just the rest. And everything is double stacked, so it's really quite hard to find things. And I can't find any of the Jim Jarmusch films. Where are they hiding out? But we have not invested in many Blu-rays. I think we have two. And it would not give me qualm to line them up next to the DVDs, really.
Well, I think if you only have two or three Blu-rays, then it's reasonable to keep them separately because they're kind of for special, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's like when people have a whole dining room that they only go into when they have guests around. You know, you could be like, oh, darling, should we watch a Blu-ray? But if you've got a collection of Blu-rays and a collection of DVDs, then I agree that whether you do them alphabetically or by genre, the Blu-rays mix with the DVDs. I know they're different height boxes, but I think actually that's rather nice over a series of units.
I think a lot of people are going to be listening to this and thinking, why are you bothering? There's Netflix.
Why don't you just download everything?
Yeah, hard copy is sometimes useful, you know, guys, and we've got
and
a cap on our bandwidth.
Yeah, and it is that thing of sort of telling people, isn't it, what you like. You know, it's all very well saying, oh, I downloaded Pulp Fiction, but you want Pulp Fiction on your shelf so that people know you like Pulp Fiction. Until about 2007, I was probably still the kind of person that would categorise my DVD collection. And now, because I think, well, it's all just worthless junk, isn't it? It's all just discs in shiny boxes. It's just like when you walk into HMV and you're like, well, this is pointless. It's like that.
The rest is noise.
I sort of assume that other people, I project upon other people that they must come into my flat and feel the same. But of course, a lot of people probably don't. They probably come in and they think, oh, he's got two copies of Bad Santa. What does that mean? You know, actually,
it means
two people gave me a copy of Bad Santa.
And you haven't got rid of it yet.
No.
You don't even like it.
I think it's all right. It's all right. I watched it this Christmas, actually, it's all right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it bears once a year viewing.
But the point is, certainly, the 25-year-old Ollie Mann would have taken one of those copies and given it to the charity shop.
Yes.
And taken the other one and put it next to my other frat pack comedy films.
Whereas the current Ollie Mann would like the option to have a copy of Bad Santa, one in the living room and one maybe in your country house that you haven't got yet.
Oh, that would be nice, yeah. You're right, that's what I'll say when people say, why have you got two copies?
And then they'll say, well, haven't you got everything digital? And then access it from the cloud in your many locations. You know, you can't win with you people, listeners, is what I'm saying. Although we did win quite significantly after last week's plea to send us the visual evidence of your Rude Thornton's request.
That's right.
You did it!
You did.
Beauties!
If you would like to see the gallery of rude words that you guys have had written on Thornton's chocolates, we asked for photo proof. We got it. It is on our website.
AnswerMeThisPodcast.com/chocolate-c-bomb. Got that chocolate C-bomb. And we didn't just have the photographic proof. We also had proof from within the company.
I'm Ben. I work for a branch of Thornton's. After some digging, I found out that unless the person behind the till is personally offended by the message that you put on, they cannot refuse to put a message on. So if it was a racial slur, we wouldn't be able to do it. But if it was something like happy birthday slur, which we have had, we could do it because it appears to us to be in good fun, rather than being in a malicious or cruel way.
But apparently, Helen, this is not company policy, according to Thornton's.
Oh, I hope I haven't got Ben into trouble then.
Well, a lady called Yvonne has tweeted me saying, oops, I posted a link to your Thornton's page to my friend who works there. Management saw the post and are calling all employees, warning them they can lose their jobs if they've taken part in it.
Are we going to get a cease and desist from Thornton's saying, stop encouraging people to violate our icing policy?
Oh, it's just a bit of fun, Thornton's. We're not going to get them to do anything really horrible. It's just fun.
If anything, it makes you look good because you're giving this personalised service. You're not like one of those evil factories, icing only, communist slogans onto chocolate.
Yeah, that's right. And as Ben said, they can't refuse certain offers. Now, I've heard some people have said the offer they can't refuse is a £1 tip. So again, Thorntons, look at your own policy there. Think what you're paying your staff. Anyway, you should head to our website to see the gallery. It is great. And also, of course, there are links there as well to download our first 3 years' worth of episodes.
And also our contact details if you would like to send us a question. And please return next week when we'll try to ruin the lives of some other staff of a shop.
Bye!